Invest with confidence.
Well, good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Lori. Coming up today, we're going to talk about an International Women's Day event that takes place in Ybor City tomorrow night. And then later, we're going to talk with an expert on why people immigrate to the U.S. And we'll also talk about the Central American gangs, such as MS-13 and M-18. You're listening to WMNF in Tampa. Well, yesterday we celebrated International Women's Day here on WMNF, a full day of programming by and for women. And tomorrow night there's an International Women's Day event in Ybor City in Tampa. And we're joined now by Sky Schmelzer, who is one of the organizers of the event tomorrow night to celebrate International Women's Day. And Sky, welcome back to WMNF. Good to have you here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So tell us what's going on tomorrow night.
So I'm part of an organization called Tampa Bay Democratic Socialists of America, and specifically I'm involved with their Socialist Feminist Working Group. And what I've done with three other co-organizers who are also in the working group is we've created this event. We call it Tampa Bay DSA International Women's Day Celebration, which is specifically a celebration of women, femmes, and queers. And yeah, it's going to be fun. There are going to be tons of vendors, lots of women, feminist vendors, selling all sorts of different things from vegan goodies to clothing, handmade clothing, jewelry, things of that nature. And we're also going to have live performances by local poets and local bands and other artists. We're going to have a drag king. It's going to be great.
So, Sky, you're with the Democratic Socialists of America. What's the connection between democratic socialism and feminism and International Women's Day?
That's a great question. So, International Women's Day has roots in the working class, specifically in regards to women, the women working class. As a lot of people may not know, the first union ever in the history of the United States was actually created among textile workers who were women. And so, it traces back even further than that internationally, but that's kind of a little bit of history of here at home. So it's important to DSA to, uplift women's voices, to, put them front and center, to give them an opportunity to express themselves, whether or not they identify as socialists does not matter. We have tons of different people coming out from all sorts of different backgrounds. And yeah, that's I hope that answers your question.
Yeah, it does. And Sky, tell us when and where the event takes place tomorrow night.
Yeah, so it's at a little cafe. It's called The Bunker. It actually has a lot of space outside, which is where most of it's going to be. So if you're coming out, bring some warm clothes, maybe an umbrella, because the weather forecast has been going off and on. It might drizzle a little bit, but we're going to have vibrant music. Tons of people are going to come out. It's going to be really warm because of that. So it's going to be at The Bunker. It's in Ybor, and it's from 6 p.m. until midnight.
All right, and that's the International Women's Day event that's going on in Ybor City tomorrow night. Sky Schmelzer, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF. Is there anything else you want to point out?
Oh, no. I just wanted to say thank you so much for having us, and if anybody has any questions, feel free to check out the Facebook event page, which is titled Tampa Bay DSA International Women's Day Celebration. You can also go to our website, which is tampabaydsa.org, or check out our Facebook page, okay?
All right, Sky, thanks a lot.
All right, thank you for having me.
Thanks, Sky. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, you're listening to WMNF in Tampa, 88.5 FM. Let's go back to last summer and listen in on a bit of a speech that President Trump gave on Long Island, and it was about the danger of gangs and the danger of immigrants.
Together, we're going to restore safety to our streets and peace to our communities, and we're going to destroy the vile criminal cartel MS-13 and many other gangs. But MS-13 is particularly violent. They don't like shooting people because it's too quick. It's too fast. I was reading one of these animals was caught and explaining they like to knife them and cut them and let them die slowly because that way it's more painful and they enjoy watching that much more. These are animals.
President Trump last summer, as he spoke to a group of law enforcement officials on Long Island about the dangers of Central American gangs. We're going to talk about that, and we're going to talk about immigration with Harry Vanden, who is a professor at the School of Interdisciplinary Global Studies at the Institute for the Study of Latin America and the Caribbean at USF in Tampa. And Harry's been doing a lot of research and expert witness work on immigration for those who are fleeing Central America. And he's also been studying gangs like MS-13 and M-18. And Harry Vanden, welcome to WMNF. Nice to see you.
Good to see you, Rob. Pleasure to be here.
All right. So just first of all, your quick take on what President Trump said there last summer about this gang MS-13.
As sometimes occurs with our president, unfortunately, there are several errors of facts in that brief statement. Firstly, MS-13 is not a cartel. It's a juvenile gang actually starting in Los Angeles, South Central, in the 1980s. It's American-made, American-born. And secondly, lamentably, the MS-13 does do more than just cut up people. Most of them are, in fact, armed. And most of the assassinations they engage in are done by guns, not by knives or machetes.
Okay, so they were started in the U.S. by mainly people from one country?
Yeah, well, no, actually, we talk about the northern tier of Central America, meaning El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. There were civil wars, bloody ones in Guatemala, in El Salvador. There was conflict in Honduras. There was the war going on between the Nicaraguan government and the Contras. And the United States supported the governments in both Guatemala and El Salvador, both of which were, frankly, horrendously violent, etc. I'd written pieces on them. Amnesty International, America's Watch had done pieces on them, indeed accusing the governments of state terrorism. The government in Guatemala was even accused of genocide for killing so many of the indigenous people. So that was the basis. People were fleeing for their lives. Some governments that were strongly supported by the United States, and many were allowed to come in the United States. Some were given special protective status. And they lived in poor neighborhoods in places like South Central Los Angeles, a few in Chicago and elsewhere. And the kids soon found that they were being persecuted by the other gangs, the local gangs. So they eventually sort of organized themselves and started these two major gangs, MS-13, or the Mara Salvatrucha, and M-18. Both Mara Salvatrucha means a Central American gang, it's Central American slang for gangs, and Salvatrucha means sort of streetwise or wise guy, so that's where they got the name. 13, M's the 13th letter of the alphabet, etc., so that's how they got. M18 was for a street in Los Angeles, and for a gang that started there, actually a Mexican gang that the Central Americans took over. So that's the origins, and then as these kids got criminal records. Once they became involved in gang activities, they got deported back to Central America. And once there, their juvenile gang sort of evolved into something a little bit different than it was in the U.S. There was a lot of violence. There was a lot of terrorism. There were a lot of armaments in Central America. So these kids picked these up and sort of notched it up a little bit and became rather violent. And, of course, a great deal of the violence and many of the murders, assassinations are actually between these two groups because they're bitterly opposed to each other. In fact, they can't even put them in the same cell block, let alone the same cells in the prisons in El Salvador, Honduras, or Guatemala.
So you're saying that when the people were leaving countries like Guatemala and El Salvador, that they weren't violent, but they come here to the U.S. and then they become violent in the U.S.?
Well, yeah, these were just refugees who were fleeing for their lives, actually, more likely kids of refugees. And when they got here, they were confronted with a violent reality, which includes so many gangs in South Central Los Angeles, even some here in Tampa, certainly a lot in New York and Long Island. And these kids felt they had to protect themselves. And basically, they just picked up on American juvenile gangs and formed these groups to protect themselves. So it's American made, it has its American origins, and that is sort of belies, I believe, a lot of what the president's saying, and that's one of the reasons I wanted to talk about it, because people need to know the connection between the U.S. and El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and the connection between these gangs. It should, of course, be noted that a lot of the badly needed socioeconomic changes that people were struggling for in Central America, particularly Guatemala and El Salvador, were strongly resisted by the U.S. U.S. resisted things in Nicaragua. Nicaragua managed to have a revolution and make a lot of basic socioeconomic changes. And interestingly enough, even though Nicaragua is a little bit poorer than the other three, Nicaragua does not have a major gang problem. And MS-13 and M-18 really don't operate very much at all in Nicaragua. So that's sort of an interesting contrast.
We're going to open up the phone lines and take some phone calls, too. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. We're talking about gangs. We're talking about immigration to the U.S., and we're talking about deportations with Harry Vanden, who's a professor at USF in Tampa. He's been there a long time and was on these airwaves a lot in the 1980s, as we much discussed Nicaragua and El Salvador and human rights there. So, Harry, just generally speaking, today, why are people leaving? Are people still leaving Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras to come to the U.S.?
Yeah, they certainly are, and for a variety of reasons. But ironically, one of the prime reasons, and particularly for young kids, unaccompanied minors and others, is that the gangs have become very strong, very violent, very dangerous there. As you indicated, I do a lot of expert witness work with immigration lawyers and immigrants all over the country, and I've done a couple in United Kingdom and one in Canada. And most of the people that I deal with are fleeing from the gangs. The gangs extort people. They try to increase their numbers by forced recruitment. And if you won't pay their extortion, if you won't agree to become a gang member, then they start leaning on you, and they lean on you heavier and heavier, threaten you, beat you up, threaten your families, and eventually may kill you. So a lot of people, particularly the younger people who come to the United States now, are literally fleeing from their lives from these very gangs that we're talking about.
Do sometimes parents send their kids north just to get them out of the way of the gangs?
Yes, they do. They try different things. Unfortunately, the gangs are assiduous enough, organized enough, and mean enough to track people all over the country, particularly El Salvador, which is pretty strong. So even if people try to relocate or get away from them in the country, that's oftentimes, in fact, mostly not sufficient, and they just feel they have to leave the country to escape this violence.
So if you're like a 12 or 13 or 14-year-old, you're in Salvador, you're in Honduras where these gangs are active, they may try to recruit you. If you say no to the gang, what does the gang say back?
Well, the gang says, you should think about that. And then they'll come and talk to you again, and they'll say, well, you should really consider what you're doing. And then after that, you really want to help yourself. You really want to protect yourself. We'll show you a good time, blah, blah, blah. You know, they try to recruit them with candy as well as, the stick, or carrot as well as the stick. But after a while, they just sort of up it. They'll, slap someone around, beat someone, pull out a knife or a gun, threaten them with it. And then they'll threaten family members, oftentimes the youngest woman in a family. It's a particular target for them. And if the person will not comply with their recruitment demands, not request demands, they eventually will kill them, as they have hundreds of people in these three countries, if not more than that.
It's got to be a harrowing trip to go from Central America all the way north through Mexico and then show up in South Texas or southern Arizona. That's got to be a a very dangerous trip for a 12 or 13-year-old, for anybody.
Yeah, it is dangerous. It is difficult. Sometimes the family, if they have any money, employ a coyote or someone to take them through. But even these coyotes are very corrupt, and they'll turn them over to the gangs or extort them, etc. But no, it's very dangerous. And there are gangs and different groups, some of the same groups, that prey on these young people and older people at the border, and indeed going through Mexico. Of course, the Mexican authorities oftentimes try to restrict them and send them back as well. So it's very harrowing, very dangerous, and takes some time.
What's the relationship between the governments of that region of El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras? What's the relationship between those governments and these gangs?
Well, the governments are diametrically opposed to the gangs. They have been trying to suppress them for the better part of 10 years as they've grown and become stronger. And they don't seem to be able to do it is the answer to that. Like the U.S., they've sort of militarized the struggle against the gangs. So they've taken, as they say, a mano duro, or heavy hand, hard hand, and tried to arrest them, put them in prison, etc. They're generally unsuccessful in that. So the governments are sort of discredited by the population for not being able to control the gangs, for not being able to control the violence. So it was just an election in El Salvador this past Sunday, and the opposition, the FMLN, finally got to power after sort of being watered down.
They were the guerrillas in the 1980s.
They were the guerrillas in the 1980s.
The leftists. Yeah.
Yes. And so they came to power a few years ago, but now the opposition, the right wing, a vicious right wing party, frankly, that was started in large part with the help of people in the U.S., has gotten a majority in the legislature. So that's sort of a protest vote against the government there that has been trying very hard to get rid of the gangs or suppress the gang violence. Unfortunately, they indeed may have gone over the top. One of the things they've done in the last year or so is to enact what they call medios especiales, or special means, where they train, in essence, a battalion of police, sort of arming them heavily, giving them special training, and authorizing them to just sort of go in a neighborhood and clean out the gangs. And they are supported by a specially trained battalion in the military that accompanies the police and even has arrest powers. So this sort of very vigorous, violent response has been what the Salvador government has felt it had to do, sort of as the last measure in order to stop the gang violence. And human rights organizations and the Ombudsman for Human Rights in El Salvador are starting to give statistics on extrajudicial executions that these police and military groups are engaging in. And the gangs have, you know, are equally vicious, and they've killed large numbers of police officers, a few military people, and even family members of military and police. I was just there in October, and while I was there, policemen or two were killed. In one instance, the policeman, his wife, and young child were killed by gang members. A sergeant was killed in the military, etc. So it's really become a very vicious struggle, with the police becoming ever more violent and vicious and the gangs responding in kind.
We're talking with Harry Vanden. We're talking about immigration. We're talking about gangs. And we're talking about President Trump and some of the things that he said about that. Our phone number is 813-239-9663. And our email address is dj@wmnf.org. If you want to send a message to us here in the studio, let's go to a call from Larry in Sarasota. Larry, what's your question for Professor Vanden?
Hey, Rob. Love the show. Professor, thanks for coming on. My question is this. It seems like you've studied Central and South America quite a bit. Why is it that our northern neighbor, Canada, is productive and has law and order, but Mexico and Central America is just so corrupt? Is it the government? Is it our support for illegal government or rash government? Is it? Because I know the Mexican people are hardworking, they're family oriented, they're religious. So what keeps them in the corrupt state of a third world country?
Well, everything you say and much more. course, parts of Mexico are quite advanced. Indeed, I drove over here in a car that's made in Mexico, by the way, as many of our cars are. But it has to do with a lot of factors going back to how they were colonized by the Spaniards, how the Spaniards completely destroyed indigenous culture, indigenous organization, deprecated the people, forced them into slavery or near slavery, etc., and how the elites who were put in place by the Spaniards have manipulated and exploited the masses of the people. El Salvador is a great example of this, where you have 14 families who control or have controlled historically most of the wealth and a great deal of the power in the country. So there are a variety of different causes. Certainly the U.S. has exploited the Latin Americans, has kept them in subordinate status. I was just indicating that the real attempts to change, to remedy some of these conditions that you point out in the 1980s in Guatemala, in El Salvador, and of course elsewhere, were strongly resisted by the U.S. The U.S. Spent $5 billion, I say billion dollars, in El Salvador in the 1980s to stop the left, the guerrillas, from winning. And in the process, empowered a right-wing groups, groups that even killed the archbishop while he was saying mass, Romero, and engaged in very violent and vicious state terrorist activities.
Harry, you say that in Nicaragua they don't really have this problem. Now, Nicaragua was the country that President Reagan fought so hard against, the Sandinista government in that country. President Reagan didn't like those folks, but it turns out that they're able to resist this kind of narco-terrorism in Nicaragua.
Yes, it's rather interesting, and it's surprising because Nicaragua is still relatively poor. In other words, the income, the sort of living standard in Nicaragua is a bit less than El Salvador, Guatemala, or Honduras, at least generally. But they were able to make enough changes. They were able to establish the Sandinista police, a very effective police force, and they have been able to pretty much resist gangs in Nicaragua. There are a few gangs, but they're local gangs, and there's nothing like the spread that we see in El Salvador, for instance, with the MS-13 and M-18.
Would you call the Nicaraguan government, is it competent? I mean, I think Larry was getting at the point, why do we have so many failed governments in Central America? Would you call the Nicaraguan government a competent government?
Yeah, I think that'd be a fair statement. They have been, and indeed they are, and they do function much better than the other governments, and they're much less corrupt. No government's perfect, but in comparison, they're much, much better. Yes,
all right, good point. Larry, go ahead.
If I was the president, I'd stop trading with China on a large basis, and I would build Central and South America, and I would promote democracy in our hemisphere instead of Red China, and hopefully, because the United States can't bring in every South and Central American immigrant. We need to build their countries to be strong and prosperous.
Yeah, I think you're quite right. In other words, so long as you have these vicious gangs, so long as you have dire poverty, so long as you have the depredation of so many people, so long as you have a small oligarchy that dominates and controls and enjoys most of the wealth, power, prestige in a country while the masses suffer, people, yes, are going to be forced to leave. And people don't do that. They don't make that trip easily. They don't leave their roots, families, homes, etc., easily, but they feel obliged to. So whatever we would do with China, we certainly need to support real and thoroughgoing change in Central America. One of the sad things about studying the gangs and this phenomena is that there's very little done to actually change the socioeconomic conditions or even to offer these young people alternatives to the gangs. And that is probably the most effective thing that could be done in the long run.
What would have happened if we would have been building, instead of Afghanistan, Central and South America, to protect our hemisphere?
You know, people like myself who study Latin America have made that argument for some time. And of course, the Latin Americans feel slighted. The U.S. Spent and was heavily involved in Central America in the 80s, as Rob said, and indeed WNF was very supportive of different voices that were not always in the press. Unfortunately, most of those changes were trumped, to play on words, by U.S. action and U.S. policy. So the changes that were so badly needed did not take place. The two countries, for instance, specifically in Central America, that have undergone revolutions have the slightest gang problem in Central America. And those are Costa Rica, which had a democratic revolution in 48 through the early 50s, and of course Nicaragua, that had a revolution from 1979 to 1990, and now has the left back in power.
All right, Larry, thanks. Good questions, and thanks a lot for your questions.
Thank you.
All right, great to hear from you. 813-239-9663. I should say that in the 1980s, WMNF was investigated by the Reagan administration. They sent down investigators to question some of the people on our news team because we were putting on the voices of peace and social justice on the air, which I think was back in the 1980s a radical thing. You're listening to 88.5 FM. Harry Vanden is here. He's a professor at USF. He's also been doing research and a lot of expert witness work on immigration, especially about those people who are escaping Central America and escaping the gangs, MS-13 and M-18. Harry, I want to play one more soundbite from President Trump. This is also part of the speech that he gave this summer on Long Island about immigrants and violence.
It's essential that Congress fund another 10,000 ICE officers, and we're asking for that, so that we can eliminate MS-13 and root out the criminal cartels from our country. Now, we're getting them out anyway, but we'd like to get them out a lot faster. And when you see these towns, and when you see these thugs being thrown into the back of a paddy wagon, you just see them thrown in, rough. I said, please don't be too nice. Like when you guys put somebody in the car and you're protecting their head, you know, the way you put their hand over. Like, don't hit their head and they've just killed somebody, don't hit their head. I said, you can take the hand away, okay?
Well, that crowd liked that statement from the president. The civil liberties aspect aside, Harry, I want to ask about deportations. When ICE, under President Obama and now under President Trump, steps up deportations, are they deporting the bad people? Or what's going on when they deport people back to Mexico or the rest of Central America?
Well, they deport everyone is the answer to that. Their criteria is, of course, those who are here without documentation are, in many cases, those who are here with documentation, legally, if you will, who have been arrested and convicted for another offense. Even if you're here since you're 2 years old and have an offense, usually a felony, but even a minor one, such as drug possession, that can get you thrown out of the country. So the people they throw out, the people that they are able to extricate from the country are not necessarily the criminals. Many of them are hardworking family people. There was a case of one Mexican woman who begged not to be sent back because she had a very abusive husband. She was sent back and he killed her. So there are many cases like that too, and we have to look at the whole spectrum and not allow ourselves to be manipulated by what is really a demagogic rhetoric. Obviously President Trump and those around him on the right are trying to denigrate all immigrants, particularly all Latin immigrants, and there is clearly an element of racism here, by focusing on the gangs and misrepresenting and even exaggerating what they do. I did come across a statistic. My friend Eileen Frank, who's a retired USF librarian, research librarian, now works at USF, was able to find all these articles in Florida newspapers, including the St. Pete Times and others. And it's interesting because it comes up that there are something like 1.4 million gang members in the United States, and this horrible MS-13 has about 1% of that. So there are very few people. The FBI estimates are between 6,000 and 10,000 people in the U.S. So Mr. Trump is focusing on this, is exaggerating it, is indeed forcing law enforcement to spend – disordinate amount of their resources trying to deal with this relatively small threat, though certainly they are violent, and you have to recognize that. But rather than dealing with the root causes, as Larry suggested, we're going to try to beat them back, deport them, and then wonder why things get worse there and more people come.
I want to ask you about Mexico. When President Trump launched his campaign just a few days after that, he talked about wanting to halt immigration from Mexico and said Mexico sends its worst people to the U.S. Well, are people still coming from Mexico, and why do they come from Mexico?
They surely are. And unfortunately, in Mexico, you have another phenomenon. They're not gangs, they're cartels. And I've had the opportunity to speak with many people who have been on the wrong end of cartel violence, and they're extremely violent, even more than the gangs are. So many of the people who flee Mexico are fleeing the violence, the cartels, all over Mexico. Of course, there are economic immigrants as well. But relations between the U.S. and Mexico are not too good. It seems that the main thing Mr. Trump wants to do for Mexico is build a wall, and of course that infuriates the Mexicans.
If those countries were Mexico's fairly stable. I was just there for a wedding, for a weekend wedding a few months ago. I wouldn't say that Mexico was unstable, but Salvador, Honduras, Guatemala. If those countries were stable and if Mexico's economy was better, would those people who are coming here now choose to leave their country to come here?
Well, I most would not, clearly. We do have to talk about violence, though, because the level of violence in Mexico is high. It's not high every place, but where the cartels operate, and indeed they sometimes act as the de facto governments in places like Michoacán or Sinaloa, where the Sinaloa cartel operates, or elsewhere. In these areas, people are terrorized. The cartels will send their people midday to assassinate someone or take them away. So you have to deal with the violence. But certainly, people, again, don't leave their homes, don't leave their families, don't leave their roots just for fun. They do it only when they're forced to and feel they have no alternatives. So certainly improving the economic conditions, improving the pay, the standard of living, the benefits that Mexican workers receive would go very far towards diminishing that immigration that we now experience.
Do you think that NAFTA has forced Mexican farmers off their land because American agricultural goods are cheap now?
It definitely has. Most Mexican small farmers, of course, grew corn. Now, because of the way our agro-industry works and because of the pressures on American farmers, and they are pressed very hard, they have to produce huge amounts of grain from every little square foot. I lived in the Midwest for a while and saw them literally plant corn or wheat in their front yards just because they had to do that. So because of all these reasons, the U.S. produces grain, corn in particular, very cheaply, much more cheaply than the small farms in Mexico have. So thousands of small farmers, corn and other, have been driven out of business in Mexico and had no other place to go.
Harry Vanden is with us. He is a professor at USF in Tampa, and he's been an expert witness on immigration issues, especially looking at Central American immigration issues and deportations. Harry, can you tell us the story of maybe somebody on behalf of whom you testified? Can you share a story with us of somebody that you testified on behalf of in court?
Well, we have to maintain confidentiality, but perhaps a bit of a composite. One of the nasty things that the gangs do in regard to unaccompanied minors is these are young guys. They range in age usually from 12 to 20, 22, sometimes even below that, as young as 9 or 10. And they oftentimes come from broken homes. They have difficult backgrounds. They're not well educated or not well cared for or not well brought up, if you will. So their idea of getting a girlfriend maybe just is to see a young woman on the street and say, you know, you're cute. They may say some more vulgar things as well. And they pursue this young woman. And the young woman says no. And they say, well, you better consider that. You know, in fact, something might happen to your family. And if the young woman, call her Juana, you know, persists in rejecting one of these guys, they up the ante. They may take her. They may rape her. They may gang rape her. They may even kill family members. And so in order to escape this violent rape, torture, and indeed assassination, and to preserve her families, many of these young women just have to leave.
Is there something in U.S. foreign policy? We talked a little bit about NAFTA a second ago. Is there anything that we should do as a government to try to reduce the violence and help these people stay at home?
Surely. I mean, one of the best things we could do is we are, you know, supposedly aiding in the fight against the gangs. But what we're doing is giving more resources to the military, giving more resources to the police, training the police, et cetera, sort of with this militarized policy. One of the things we might do is set up alternatives for the young people, even funding places to remove tattoos. The quickest way for someone to identify a gang member is to see their tattoos. They were very heavily tattooed before. More recently, they're not doing that. But if a person wants to leave a gang, which is very difficult, by the way, but if a person wants to leave a gang, and even if they let him out, which they don't always do, if he or even she goes to a business and tries to get a job, if anyone sees the tattoos, they won't hire them. So that's one thing that could help. But the other thing is we need to provide alternatives for these young people so they can get a job, sustain themselves, and get away from the gang culture. Ironically, this gang is not a super wealthy international criminal organization. Sometimes there is a bit of trans-border interaction. But most of these folks are kind of poor, raggedy even. So, you know, they're not living real high off the hog. So just giving people a decent paycheck and support would, I think, make a difference. Changing socioeconomic conditions is one of the best ways to abolish the conditions that that cause, feed, and allow for gangs to develop and prosper.
Let's take another phone call. We're going to go to Terry, who's in Tampa. Terry, you're on the air with Professor Harry Vanda, and we're talking about gangs and immigration and deportations. What would you like to ask Harry?
Well, I'd like to make a little brief little statement about the, you know, what's going on is, and I hope you don't take it personally, but it's very racist. You know, the whole deportation issue, you know, coming and taking people out of their homes and jobs and schools and away from their families and, you know, taking their property. And this situation is absolutely horrendous. And I think you have to look back on, you know, the history of this country and how the blacks in America have been mistreated and the laws have been ignored that are supposed to be protecting us under the Constitution. And then when our help didn't come from the other population portion, then it went to another population that was even more vulnerable, you know, those who are the others. And that's what we keep looking for here, some others. And I'm afraid that after we get rid of the all those that we deem desirable, undesirable from other countries, we're going to turn that ugly machine inside. And, you know, that's where it looks like it's trending. And I feel very sorry for the people that are being deported in such a horrendous way. And I hope that a solution can be found to keep the families together. Thank you very much, Rob.
All right, Terry, thanks. Thanks for your comments.
Yeah, thanks, Terry. Obviously, it's a very strong racist element of this. MS-13 is singled out because it's sort of symbolic of the stereotypical view that Latin immigrants are dangerous, you know, as you said, of Mexicans who came across the border, rapists, and others. So it's very easy then to mobilize some of the racist folks in this country, which is not a vast majority of the population, but there is that element still, and it's very easy to mobilize those sentiments against Latinos and against, frankly, people of color. And you're quite right, but I mean, this this administration, of course, has shown itself to be rather strongly against Arabs, Muslims, Middle Easterners, Latins, Mexicans, Salvadorans, and indeed American people of color as well. There's clearly a racist element, as we've seen in several instances, etc. And there even is, in some of the people who support him, an anti-Semitic element as well. So this indeed is a administration that has, I think, justly been accused of racism and even anti-Semitism. And I think that indeed does need to be resisted, etc. And you're quite right, you know, as the minister said, you know, first they come for the communists, then they come from the labor unionists, and then they come for others. And finally, when they come for me, there's no one left to protect me. And I think we need to keep that in our minds.
Harry, how many Central American countries have you traveled to over the last 30 or so years?
Oh, I've been to all of them. I've traveled Central America by buses, which is really the only way to go,
and
including
you speak
Belize.
Fluent Spanish.
I'm almost bilingual, yes.
Yeah. Here's an email. This is a hostile email, and it's anonymous, mm-hmm. and the person says the people come from Mexico because Mexico is a s-hole, quoting the president of a few weeks ago, and he says that, I'm assuming it's a he, they want to make America more like home. Getting sent back to us is punishment. You are snowflakes. You know, this idea that it's not very coherent, but this idea that Mexico is an s-hole, I mean, I've been to Mexico several times. That's not what I found. What would you say to this caller who thinks that Mexico is an s-hole?
Well, I mean, I think you should go, frankly. But, you know, Mexico has many faces, many parts of it. One can go to Mexico City and go to neighborhoods, areas that are absolutely delightful, where Frida Kahlo's house is, for instance.
They just had a golf tournament last weekend in Mexico. Phil Mickelson won it. I mean, it was... golf course was nice. I mean, not that that's the only standard, but go ahead. I interrupted.
No, but I mean... Mexico has, you know, has everything, and I think that, I mean, that's just not understanding, you know, how people are, what people are. I sort of started off by saying, you know, I came here in a car made in Mexico. Well, more and more cars are made in Mexico because Mexico has very excellent skilled workers, has engineers, has managers. Electronics have been made in Mexico for years and years. The Mexicans have produced many of their own things. Indeed, you know, this is the case since the time of the Aztecs and Mayas in southern Mexico. So there is a great deal of culture, etc., music, and a very learned tradition there, you know. So I don't accept that.
I hesitate to bring it up, but I think that there are people out there that think that, so I want to read it.
I think you're right, unfortunately.
Here's an email from Margaret. She says, I recently left Sonora, Mexico, located south of Arizona. I was there over 2 months in a town called Alamos. I've been visiting since 2011. As a bilingual speaker, I've developed many close friendships. It is common knowledge about locals who cross the border in the Nogales areas to seek work in Arizona. One father recently crossed with his 18-year-old son, and they are working construction in Phoenix. He was a former coyote who knows the routes. He still had to leave his vehicle and home in Nogales as payment for a safe house once he crossed to the U.S. What I understand is that there are many Arizona businesses complicit with using illegal workers. They are still there working. They arrived 2 months ago. I'd like to hear Harry's comments about the situation.
Well,
so people crossing the border to get work temporarily.
Sure. I mean, of course, we had a program called the Bracero program going back a few years, I guess, to the 1960s, and that might be something we'd want to exploit and develop further. That is, say, allowing people to come legally, work for a time, send money home, and then go back home. But certainly many businesses and types of businesses are heavily dependent on immigrant labor, and indeed, oftentimes, they don't specify or they don't practice full due diligence to separate those who have papers from those who do not. Right in Florida, we have a large number of Latinos who work in the construction industry. We have also a large contingent of Latinos who work in the agricultural industry. So certainly those who work in businesses in southern Arizona, New Mexico, et cetera, is not unusual. And indeed, many people heavily depend on this type of labor and on this immigrant labor, whether it be with papers or without. So Yes, I think that that is a very legitimate point, and that needs to be brought out, and we need to recognize this and make it possible for people to come and work in American businesses and do so legally and do so with legal protection and do so with benefits and then be able to return home to their homes, their families, and their places of birth.
And now we're seeing reports of shortages in some of the agricultural areas in Texas, California, and Florida, that there's not enough workers to harvest the crops.
Yes, indeed. As we were saying, heavily dependent on it. When you stop that flow of labor, these businesses are going to be very heavily and very negatively impacted. I think many businessmen are quite clear on that.
Let's go back to the phones. You're listening to a live interview on WMNF in Tampa, and let's go to Frank in Sarasota. Frank, thanks for calling. You're on the air with Professor Harry Vanden. What's your question?
My question is, I was reading that a lot of this MS-13 is concentrated in Suffolk County, and I was kind of wondering, we grew up in Nassau County as children, and all I remember about Suffolk County is wealthy enclaves and along the seashore and duck farms. Why are they going there? I realize that they have family there already, so they're emigrating to be with them, but how do they get started there? They go up there to work on duck farms?
Well, I'm not sure of all the reasons, quite frankly, but Suffolk County, D. Log Island, has a concentration of immigrants from El Salvador. Other areas that also have a concentration, interestingly enough, are Washington, D.C., and Northern Virginia and Maryland around it. So where you get the large concentration of Latins, particularly Salvadorans, as well as Hondurans and Guatemalans, the gangs are able to spread. One of the points that needs to be made is that many of the people who eventually become members of these gangs were not so when they came. They were recruited in the United States, and Suffolk County is, of course, a good example of that, and brought into the gangs and forced to stay in the gangs after they were already here.
All right, Frank, there you go. There's the answer.
Thanks a lot.
All right, thanks. And you, Harry, you said a moment ago that the numbers for MS-13 might be quite small, 6,000 to 9,000. Am I quoting you right?
Yes, you are. That's what the FBI says, even in their press statement.
This would be nationwide.
Yes, this is nationwide.
Yeah. So you are there other hotbeds besides Long Island? Are there other hotbeds where these folks are?
Yeah, actually, thinking a bit, I lived in New York, but not on Long Island, but the course is agriculture on Long Island. So apropos to our previous question and discussion, these folks may have been brought in or encouraged to go there to work in agriculture as well. There are, as we were saying, around Washington, D.C., in Maryland and Northern Virginia is one of the strongest. Long Island, indeed, Suffolk County is another. Los Angeles still has remnants of MS-13 from the earlier times. There are a few other places, too. According to the FBI, and this may be a bit political, but there are different groups, and the small groups are called cliques or cliques over many parts in the United States, like 40 different states. There, of course, are some folks, I'm told, who were affiliated here in Tampa as well.
Let's go to Nick in St. Pete. Nick, thanks for calling in. What's your question for Professor Harry Vanden?
I have a question, but first I'd like to thank the professor for hitting all the Democratic identity politics talking points. Sorry if you feel like a victim, Professor, but you're not. MS-13 is a very violent narco gang. They fund themselves through extortion, prostitution, sex trafficking. And have you seen the videos, Doc? When they kill people, they film it. They're available at a website called bestscore.com. If you haven't seen what these MS-13 people do to their rivals, you really ought to take a look. Thanks, Professor, for being a Democrat. Peace.
All right. Nick is always like that when he calls.
Yeah, hi, Nick. I'm glad you are not bringing any of your partisan political views into the discussion. I just want to thank you for that. But MS-13 certainly is violent, but I'm not sure whether you're confusing what MS-13 or some of the gangs do with what some of the cartels do in Mexico. But the idea that, that I'm a victim or that people are victimized by these is just not correct. The primary victims are other people from El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. And the primary victims in the United States, by the way, are other people from these same Latin communities. They're the ones who suffer this. The violence tends to be very much within the particular community or group in which these kids circulate. So the general society does not suffer greatly from these. And I think what you might want to consider would be to what extent the American-bred gangs, Crips, Bloods, others, operate in places like Chicago, and how that violence does spill over into the general community. Or for that matter, what about shootings right here in East Tampa and elsewhere, and how that spills over into the community?
I meant to keep Nick on and ask him how many Central American countries he's traveled to, but the next time he calls, I'll ask him. Let's go to Bob in Oldsmar. Bob, thanks for calling in. We're talking about immigrants and gangs. Yeah. What would you like to ask Harry?
Good afternoon. Good interview. I kind of do agree. You do definitely hitting all the points there for Democrats, but that's neither here or there. Wherever the gang was formed or the origins, that's all good, you know, historical information. But the bottom line is, I feel like, and I've said this for years, you know, why doesn't Mexico take care of its problems? I mean, the cartels, the police are afraid to even do anything. They'll assassinate police. And what I think most Americans, you know, the email you got, that's, I don't think that's, you know, I know lots of Mexicans, and they are very hardworking. They pay their rent. They, you know, they go to work. But that's not, you know, do we want that type? You know, they're coming over here because this is easy pickings. They're drug trade for the cartels. And what is it? We need legal immigration, period. It's not where, you know, they keep putting it on a race thing. We need to have legal. You just can't have people not documented. Not, you know, we have to let the gangs know.
Bob, let me ask you this.
MS-13 has to be stopped.
All right, period. So Bob, let me ask you this. If in your neighborhood you were threatened by a drug gang, and let's say that the police weren't helping in your neighborhood, would you try to leave that neighborhood?
Well, no, yeah, and I understand that. That's not my point.
Well, you said you want legal immigration. Sometimes people are going to flee because they're afraid, right?
So basically, we should just have open borders because of another country. Now, I do understand that, trust me. But it's like, then that comes here, and then we have to deal with it.
Bob, let's hear what Professor Vanden has to say about it, okay? Bob, yeah. Thanks a lot. Thanks for your call.
Sure, thanks. The cartels are bad news, but let's be clear. The Mexican government has been in a war with the cartels for the last two administrations. Thousands of Mexicans have been killed by the cartels, many police, many military, and many others resisting them. I quite agree it would be good to stop them, Bob, and I think what you should do is talk to all your friends, and I hope it doesn't include you, but it might, who use cocaine. Because so long as the cartels can import money, drugs, cocaine and others, amphetamines as well.
If we legalized all drugs, would this go away?
It would put them out of business real fast, that's for sure. Because they make huge amounts of money, and it's that huge amount of money that enables them to get the yards, pay their organization, have the transport, etc. So if we stop using drugs, or indeed if we legalize them so they were no longer the suppliers, that would put them out of business straight away and would enable Mexico to better control them. Mexico has tried very hard. It has driven some of the cartels out. It has driven some of the transportation, transshipment out of Mexico into Central America, by the way.
Does the money that the cartels make, or does the money that the gangs make, do they use that to influence politicians? Do they use it to bribe politicians?
No, sure, particularly in Mexico, though elsewhere also. So the corruption is heavily influenced by the sale of and distribution of drugs. And that is just ruinous for most of these Latin Americans. It is very easy to turn, for instance, a policeman in Guatemala, Honduras makes $200, maybe a little bit more a month. In El Salvador, 400 or a little bit more. So when you can bribe someone with $1,000 or with $10,000, it's hard to say no. And of course, the thing that the cartels in particular do is the adage of, you know, plata o plomo. That is to say, silver will pay you, but baby, if you resist, man, you're going to get lead. We're going to kill you. And that's how they're able to do it. So by using drugs in this country, we fund them, enable them, facilitate them. So it would be good to stop that. And certainly legalizing drugs, though it has problems, is perhaps much better than what we're experiencing now.
Professor Harry Vanden, thanks a lot for coming on WMNF. Nice to see you again.
Thanks, Rob. Pleasure to be here.
If people want to look up more, do you have a website, or can they email you or follow you on Twitter?
Sure. I don't do Twitter. Perhaps I might, but they're more than welcome to reach me at my email, which is my name, Vanden, at usf.edu.
Harry Vanden is a professor at the Institute for the Study of Latin America and the Caribbean at the College of Arts and Sciences at USF in Tampa. Thank you, Harry, for coming by. If you want to comment about today's show, call us up at 813-238-8001. Record your comment on extension 11.